fucking god, I'm so mad right now. Alright, guys. So, this is take three of us trying to bring you a very special episode of State of Murder, because it is Labor Day. And so we decided to do a special episode. Take one meant my computer went on the fritz and recorded all of my audio through the computer, which is completely unlistenable. Take two, my computer faked me out that it was recording and didn't record the whole lot of audio. So these stories are going to be flawless.
Oh god, I hope so.
Because we have already said them three times.
You know what? But it's like Labor Day. Let's make you work a little bit for it.
Really celebrate the holiday by putting in the work. So, before we get into part three of this episode, special shout out to Crystal Vasquez and Oscar Burgos, two very good friends of ours who are registered to vote and have completed their census. Good job, guys! Woo-hoo!
Doing your civic duty! Yeah!
Yeah! What up? So you guys are amazing, and we love you, and thanks. Let's get to the show.
Okay. I have to find... I'm like, where the hell did I put my episode? Hold on. Where's my papers? Oh, there it is.
Okay. You just ripped it up after round two.
I was like, and I'm done!
Finally, we got it! Nope,
just kidding. Okay. Labor Day. Labor Day.
Yeah. So, because it's a special Labor Day episode, we wanted to bring you not a specific state story, because that wouldn't be very fair to Alabama to try to find Labor Day stories for Alabama. We're just bringing you stories about labor unions. So me and Amber are both in two different states this week. So Amber, what Labor Day case do you have for us today?
All right. So I decided to share a story about one of my favorite types of criminals. So that's really weird that I have a favorite criminal type, but I do. And so that, of course, is mobsters. So we've talked about it, I think, numerous times, how I wanted to be a mobster girlfriend in the 1920s and 30s, not the wife, because the girlfriend had all the fun and didn't have to stay home. So, and also 1920s and 30s mobsters are way hotter than other mobsters. So just so you know, putting it out there, that's what I think, whatever.
Okay.
You can hate on me all you want. So, however, as this is a Labor Day special, I decided that I needed to at least revolve around a labor-related murder. So, on September 27th, 1972, Teamster Union official William Billy Logan was murdered outside of his house. If you don't know what the Teamster Union is, it started in 1903, and they represented, like, warehouse workers and some truck drivers, very blue-collar, the backbone of America-type workers. Mm-hmm. So there happened to actually be two eyewitnesses for this murder. So Billy Logan was gunned down. One of them was Robert Lowe, who actually identified Harry Ailman as the murderer. So he was the shooter. Now, who is Harry Ailman? Well, apparently he was one of the most feared enforcers and assassins for the Chicago Outfit during the 1970s. So the Chicago Outfit was one part of the mafia. There was, like, a New York. You had Italian mafia, which I think everybody, that's kind of what we picture. There was a Jewish mafia. There was an Irish mafia. So he was part of the Italian Chicago Outfit. He actually had the nickname Hook due to his boxing career in high school. So I'm guessing he had that awesome, like, right or left hook. I don't know which one. I mean, I think that one is stronger than the other. Fuck if I know. So Harry was actually born in Little Italy, part of Chicago. So if you read up on his criminal career, it actually apparently started in 1962 when he was charged for assaulting the son of a Chicago police commander, which it was a little confusing for me when I was reading about this crime, because It also sounded like the police commander's son was a policeman himself. So I think that's the way it was. So that's the way I'm going to report it. Okay. So apparently Harry and his buddies were out at a bar drinking, partying it up, and he ended up pushing a woman out of a window of the bar. Didn't say why. Maybe she, I don't know. Who knows why? But
what justifiable reason would you push someone out of a window?
Yeah. Well, and not just somebody. Like, I could see maybe a bar fight and, like, there was some shoving, but... And not, I'm not sexist in any way, shape, or form, but, like, in the 60s, like, I mean, there's just definitely kind of, you know, women were viewed, I mean, even now, like, if a guy did that to a woman now, people would be like, what the fuck? So, I'm like that. So, of course, after pushing a woman out the window, the cops were called, and when they arrived, he ended up getting into a scuffle with them, and he ended up punching the Chicago police commander's son in the jaw, and it broke. So he was arrested for that, obviously, and he got 2 years of probation. During the rest of the 1960s, he was arrested for numerous, like, just a smorgasbord of different things. So malicious mischief, illegal gambling, possession of burglary tools. So I don't know if he had, like, a lockpicking. Like, I don't know what the fuck burglary tools are. I picture lockpicking.
But, yeah, that's what I picture, little tiny hooks to get in there. But also, how is that illegal to have these things? Because you haven't caught him breaking into anything.
No, I don't know. So, yeah, that's kind of like arresting somebody for thinking about committing a crime, which,
yeah,
that's silly. But he also was arrested for assault, aggravated assault, grand theft auto, armed robbery, and kidnapping. So, just covering the whole wide array of things, like, just testing things out.
Yeah, you gotta try different crimes to see which crime really suits you the best.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a career fair for crimes.
Like, yeah.
Dip your toe in the water, see what you like.
Yeah, I didn't like that kidnapping, so I'm gonna try stealing some cars. I don't know.
Yeah, let's try Grand Theft Auto.
Why not? So in the 1970s, Ailman started to be kind of an enforcer for the mob. So he would go to the local bookmakers in Chicago and would extort a street tax from them for the outfit, which from my understanding, like, a street tax is kind of like paying them to be able to be there and also maybe for some protection. So it was just kind of like, hey, you're going to pay your taxes. We're also going to be included and get some of your money. Mm-hmm. If they refused to pay, of course, you know, that probably that right hook came into handy and he would punch them. Who knows? But he would force them to pay. According to the Chicago Crime Commission, during this time, so between 1971 and through 1976, Harry actually committed 13 murders for the outfit. However, he was only tried for the murder of Billy Logan. So the other 12... and whatever. Nothing apparently happened with them.
Okay.
They're like, oh, murders, whatever. Who cares?
Yeah, we just care about this one.
Yeah, exactly. This is the only important one. So why did Harry shoot Billy Logan? Well, there's two stories. The first is from the FBI. So the FBI thought it was due to the fact that Billy Logan was kind of obstructing the outfit from hijacking union trucks. So he was doing his job and making sure all of the union trucks were safe because that's what he's supposed to do. And mm-hmm. So he wasn't kind of following what the mob wanted. So he wasn't letting them take their stuff, letting them buy them out. So it sounds like he was being pretty straight and narrow with that.
Mm-hmm.
However, it comes out later, his attorney shares some information on what he was told on why Harry committed this crime. So apparently, it had nothing to do with the labor union. So nothing to do with the Teamsters, nothing to do with the trucks and not being able to hijack them. It actually was a very personal motive. Apparently, Billy Logan was married to Harry's cousin. Now, I looked and looked and could not find Harry's cousin's name. So we're just going to call her Harry's cousin.
So, oh, she doesn't even get a
sorry.
Name.
I know. 70s, they didn't fucking think women mattered. No. You know what I mean? Like, shit. Okay. So, apparently, Harry's cousin and Billy Logan were getting a divorce, and it was pretty bitter. It was not an amicable divorce at all. There was a lot of fighting going on, especially around custody of Billy and his wife's son. And during these arguments and fights, it would get pretty physical. So Billy Logan, I guess, had a lot of domestic violence going on. It sounded like he beat her up quite a bit. And during one of these...
winner.
I know. I mean, he's the victim in all this, ending up dead. But we do not domestic... We don't like batterers.
No. Like, so, just because you were the victim doesn't mean that you were always a great person.
No, that's true. That is definitely true. So during one of these fights, Billy's cousin ended up putting out there that Billy was going to take care of him and, like, to be careful because... Or not Billy... Harry, sorry. Harry would take care of him because Harry was part of the mob. And so she was kind of warning him. And Billy Logan replied to her, "Fuck that guinea." Now, I didn't know what the heck a guinea was. Well, I know what a guinea is. Like, a guinea fowl is like a little bird, kind of like a pigeon.
I know, but you should also know because we've done this 3 times, Amber. Just kidding.
I know. I do know what it is. I looked it up before we did it the first time. But you know what it is. But I'm going to share it with everybody else. So.
Okay, what is it? I'll pretend to erase my mind. What is it?
Pretend you don't know anything.
The listeners are going to hate this episode.
So apparently, it's a very derogatory term towards Italians. Now, I won't ever say anything is as bad as the N-word because the connotation for that is really bad. But in, I think, Harry's mind, it was very similar. And so when Billy Logan called him that, it was really offensive. So me saying it, if you're Italian, I apologize. I do not mean to be offensive. I would never say the N-word, but I did say this word. So I don't think I could say the G-word. People wouldn't know what the hell I was talking about.
No, everyone would be super confused.
Now, he took real offense to this. So he didn't really give a shit that his cousin was being beaten by Billy Logan, but this was the, like, final straw for him. And apparently he was, when he found out, he ended up saying that Billy was not going to get away with it. No Irish goon was going to get away with calling him a guinea. And so apparently that was good enough reason to go.
Not that his cousin was the victim of domestic violence. Like,
who gives a shit if a woman gets beat? Fuck that. That's not important. Somebody calls me a bad name, they're going to get what comes to them.
Motive for murder.
Motive number one for murder. Frickin' just a verbal insult. So apparently that's, according to his attorney, that's why Harry ended up killing Billy Logan. Which, if that's true, that's fucking ridiculous. So the prosecution was really excited because they felt like they had a total open and shut case. They had an eyewitness who was in protective custody, who was totally pointing the finger at Harry. And so they knew he would be found guilty. However, the mob was like, no, this isn't going to happen. So they reached out to Harry's attorney, Cooley, and stated that he needed to get Harry a bench trial. So if you don't know what a bench trial is, you have two choices. You can have a jury trial where, you know, 12 jurors sit, they deliberate, find you guilty, innocent. Or if you want to skip that, you can provide all the evidence for the trial just to a judge. And the judge makes the decision whether you're innocent or guilty.
Actually, try that for, like, high-profile cases, right? Where, like, the jury might have been swayed by things. Don't
yeah.
They usually try to go for a bench trial for those kinds of things.
That could be. I don't really know. Sure. I mean, there are certain times where I'm like, it has to be harder than shit to find a jury that's willing to sit. Like, I would not sit, like, a jury for the mob. I would find my, like, for El Chapo's freaking, like, trial. You, no.
El Chapo.
Like, come on. Would you have been willing to sit on that jury? Fuck no.
No, I probably would have been dismissed for that. But then they, like, yeah, it might have been pretty hard. So I see the point.
So I think that maybe sometimes then would be. So Robert Cooley, Harry's attorney, was like, okay, cool. I know exactly which judge we can get that'll be able to be bribed. So they ended up getting a bench trial for Harry, and they offered Cook County Circuit Court Judge Frank Wilson $10,000 to find Harry innocent. Now, in today's monies, $10,000 is between like $40,000 and $50,000. So not like a crazy amount of money, in my opinion, but I mean, enough to make the judge go, okay, maybe. So
yeah, I mean, we talked about how bad Cook County was.
Oh yeah, so Cook County is not.
Don't think the it best. Takes much.
I mean, 10 years from now, we have a whole bunch of fucking cops just beating the shit out of people and torturing them to get them to confess to crimes they didn't commit. So that's not that far away.
Yeah.
So Judge Wilson agreed. He apparently asked for some more money than $10,000. I don't know if they gave it to him or not. It doesn't say. But in the end, he ended up finding Harry Aylman innocent. So that was not an open and shut case for the prosecution.
Yeah.
However, it wasn't long before Harry Aylman was actually put in prison. He was picked up and convicted under the RICO Act, which stands for the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act. Now, if anybody's ever watched the TV show Sons of Anarchy, you'll know that the RICO Act is no bueno for criminals. Maybe it's good for
criminals.
Well,
I'm sure it works for what it's supposed to work for, Amber.
I know, but I'm a Sons of Anarchy fan, and I didn't want them found guilty of the RICO Act, even though they were totally fucking guilty. I'm going with them. So if you are found guilty of the RICO Act, you can get like a way longer sentence than if it wasn't found under RICO. So Aylman, so Harry here went down for apparently organizing a series of home invasion robberies. So he might have liked those burglary tools a lot more than we thought. So
yeah, I guess. Yeah, maybe there was reason to arrest him for having...
Maybe it wasn't just suspicion. I mean, apparently he was doing it.
Yeah.
So he ended up getting 30 years in prison. Now, in the 1980s, the federal government started to look at all of the corruption going on in Chicago, and especially when it came to the mob and ties to the Chicago court system. So in 1993, Robert Cooley, so Harry's attorney, so this is how we heard the story about the cousin getting beat up and Guinea and all that shit. Mm-hmm. So he ended up testifying that they had in fact bribed the judge to get an innocent verdict for Harry. So as it was a corrupt trial, Harry was able to be tried for the murder of Billy Logan again. Now, normally, as we know, this doesn't happen because if you're found innocent from a crime, you can't be tried for that same crime because it would be
double jeopardy.
So apparently, Harry Aylman was the first man in U.S. history that was tried for the same murder twice. He ended up being found guilty, but he was already serving his 30-year sentence. I don't even know how long he got for the murder of Billy. However, Aylman ended up dying May 15th, 2010 from lung cancer. So Harry got married, and so he didn't have any kids of his own, but his wife did have some children, and one of his children, he had a stepdaughter named Frankie. And she was on one of those mob TV shows, like not Married to the Mob, but like the VH1 one where they like talk up to the mobster women. So she was on that show for a little bit. And apparently she's working at doing another TV show. I don't know when it's going to come out. But she stated that she had talked to Harry Aylman before he died. And he swore that he did not kill Billy Logan. So that his family thinks he's completely innocent of that murder. But he was found guilty, so we're going to just say he was guilty. So that is the story of Teamster Union official William Billy Logan and the first man in history, U.S. history, to be tried for the same murder twice.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
For the third time.
For the third time. Selena, what's your story?
Let me tell you, because you've never heard it before.
I don't know who we're talking about.
My story is about Joseph Jock Yablonski. He was a hardworking miner from Pennsylvania, and he was born on March 3rd, 1910, to Polish immigrants. He started working in the mines when he was just 15 years old, which isn't too young to be working a job in general, but I honestly feel like there's no good age to be working in a mine, especially in the early 1900s.
Yeah, 15, babysitting, like maybe like Target. Not that Target was around
then. It's in the 1920s, 30s.
I don't know what kids did back then, but not
worked in the mines. No, obviously.
No, no, that's not okay.
So, he became involved in the United Mine Workers in 1933 after his father was killed in a mine explosion, which is only a few years after he started working in the mines. In 1934, he was elected to the union office, and just 6 years later, he became a representative to the International Executive Board. He was appointed to president of the United Mine Workers Union District 5, where he served just 7 years before being removed by the new president of the union, Tony Boyle.
Okay.
So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Tony. So Tony, or Tough Tony Boyle, which, what a stupid
nickname. It's the dumbest nickname. Like, just because it's like an alliteration of the T and the T, no.
Yeah, no.
He probably wasn't really tough. He was probably weak, and it was just an ironic name.
Yeah, that's, yeah, probably was. Or my thing was, like, he, we're going to talk about how much of an asshole he was. So my vote is that he was just an asshole. And so that's where he got that nickname.
So just call him asshole. You know, asshole Tony down the block. Real fucking asshole.
Yeah, that guy. So Tony was also the son of a miner. He was born on December 1st, 1904 in Bald Boot, Montana, which, I'm sorry, I pause every single time, it's and Butte. I know I've done this so many times. It's Butte, but it makes me think of butt, because it's spelled B-U-T-T-E. Like, it looks like butt.
It does. Bald
Butt, Montana.
Okay.
Sorry for anyone who actually lives in Bald Butte, Montana.
Nothing but nothing like a bald butt.
And he worked as a miner out of high school alongside his father until his father passed away from tuberculosis, which, like, holy shit, the
1900s. Yeah. Like, nothing like explosions and TB to make a good time.
Yeah, children working in mines. So Boyle served as the president of the United Mine Workers of America, District 27, until becoming assistant to the president in 1948. Forming a strong bond with the acting president, John L. Lewis, who I guess is like a bigwig in the whole union history.
Okay.
He rose to the ranks of vice president of UMWA in 1960 after Lewis decided to retire and his vice president, Thomas Kennedy, took over as president. Despite only being a VP, due to Kennedy's failing health, Boyle took over a lot of his duties. When Kennedy died just 3 years later, Boyle was elected as president. Boyle faced a lot of opposition during his time as president, especially since the miners themselves were looking for more autonomy for their local unions. Boyle's interests seemed to align more with the mine owners than with the actual workers themselves. And this is what caused him to kind of butt heads a lot with Jock, because Jock was very much for workers' rights. Like, the whole reason he got into the union was for the safety of workers, because his dad died in a mine explosion.
Yeah, so he's the good guy. Tough Tony, Tough Toenails is the bad guy.
Yep. Real bad guy.
Real piece of work.
Mm-hmm. So, he continually found high-paying jobs in the union for family members, and soon wildcat strikes took place all over local unions in hopes to address their needs. And for anyone who doesn't know, like, unions typically, like, will put on protests to, like, protest, like, bad working conditions and wages and things like that. But a wildcat strike is a strike that's happening without the union, or kind of, like, I don't know if they're all necessarily against the union, but the union isn't backing their play. They're just striking.
Yeah.
And so Jock adamantly opposed Boyle and believed he didn't represent the needs of the miners themselves. So in May of 1969, he announced that he would be running for president of the union. Jock was outspoken about the problems within the union and sought to bring about change. Boyle was outraged, and on election day, December 9th, when he was announced as victor, by almost a 2-1 margin, many saw corruption. Jock conceded, but the following week asked the Department of Labor to investigate for fraud. As he awaited the results of the investigation, tragedy would strike. On December 31st, 1969, three hitmen would arrive at the Yablonsky household in Clarksville, Pennsylvania, around 1 a.m. They slashed the tires on Jock's Chevy, as well as the tires on his daughter Charlotte's Ford Mustang, and cut the phone lines. Which seems kind of ridiculous that they cut the tires when they plan on killing everybody.
Yeah, no, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I get the phone a little bit just because, I mean, I feel like it's easier if somebody hears something to quickly call 911. But mm-hmm. Yeah, the tires seem like a little bit redundant.
Yeah, because it doesn't even make it look like another crime.
No, it's not like they're also stealing some shit from the house, like all the valuables.
Yeah, also, like, why would you want to draw attention to the house where you're murdering someone? Because if someone looks and it's like, because it's New Year's Eve, so you have to expect the people are out late, maybe, I'm assuming still in the 1960s. And so, like, now they're going to walk by their neighbor's car and be like, somebody slashed their tires. Maybe we should call the police.
Yeah, that's pretty weird.
Because someone's, like, messing with cars in the neighborhood. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It just seems ridiculous. So they first entered Charlotte's room and shot her twice in the head. They then moved to the master bedroom where Jock and his wife Margaret were sleeping. Jock shot up and reached for the gun he kept by his bed, which in one article mentioned that he always kept it unloaded. So I don't know that, like, if he even tried to fire it or had time to fire it. But if he did, like, there probably wasn't anything in it anyway. Which, like, doesn't really make much sense that you'd keep it that close to your bed but not keep it loaded.
I mean, I know, but gun safety, so it's probably props to him for that. But yeah, it
didn't help.
No.
So his wife Margaret screamed, but the hitman fired quickly. Jock was shot a few more times as he fell to the floor to ensure that he was dead. It would be 5 days until their bodies were discovered by their son Kenneth, or Chip. I didn't explain the nickname. I don't know how you get Chip from Kenneth, but hey.
Yeah.
How do you get Jock from Joseph, I guess?
Yeah.
This sprung everyone into action. The day after the bodies were found, around 20,000 miners in West Virginia walked off the job site to strike against Boyle, who they believed to be responsible. Which, man, you got some pull if you're getting miners from West Virginia to protest a murder in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
From this guy.
Well, and obviously people were expecting or assuming that there was a lot of corruption and a lot of nothing not right going on. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So after the funeral, many of the miners who supported Jock's run for president met in secret with an attorney to draw up plans to establish a reform caucus within the United Mine Workers. This caucus would later become the Miners for Democracy. And Joseph's son, Chip, was actually like a part of the Miners for Democracy, although I don't believe he was the attorney that they were meeting with, because he was a lawyer, so that's why he got involved. But I don't believe he was there during this underground meeting. He was brought in later on. And so, on January 8th, Jock's attorney switched from asking for the right to an internal review, but instead demanded an immediate investigation into the election by the Department of Labor. Soon, 230 investigators were placed on to the UMWA investigation.
That's so freaking many people. Like,
shit. I know.
Shit. 230 people are investigating this? Dang.
Because I'm sure they were also probably looking into other things. Like, if this guy rigged the election, there's probably a million other things he did that were shitty.
Yeah, he's not. He's corrupt as shit.
Mm-hmm. So, the Department of Labor filed a suit in federal court in 1971 to overturn the election results, and on May 1st, 1972, Judge William Bryant dismissed the results and a new election was scheduled for the first week of December. The judge also stated that he wanted the Department of Labor overseeing the election to ensure that there was fairness throughout, because we know Boyle did not play fair the first time.
No.
So Arnold Miller, a miner from West Virginia who opposed Boyle on the need for legislation for the black lung, which for anyone who doesn't know is just a disease that miners get. They get a lot of stuff in there. I don't know if it's the same sort of thing as like mesothelioma or anything, but it's also it's a bad respiratory.
Yeah. And which we all know what it is because we've all seen Zoolander and his little.
I got the black lung pop.
And then wiping himself off with those little wipes, which is also what I picture what miners do is exactly what's in there, because, you know, movies.
So Arnold Miller was nominated as a candidate by the Miners for Democracy. Miller was declared the victor on December 15th with almost 20,000 more votes than Boyle. In March of 1971, Boyle, and so this is before the new election happened, Boyle was indicted for embezzling almost $50,000 in union funds to make illegal campaign contributions in the 1968 presidential race, which I believe was Nixon versus Humphreys. And so it kind of makes me laugh that Nixon was a crook and so is this guy.
Yeah. And I think Nixon had a lot of ties to stuff like that, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah,
and even though they don't say what his illegal contribution was, I immediately know that it was to Nixon's campaign.
Yeah, I just assumed too.
Yeah, just assume. So he was convicted and sentenced to a 3-year sentence in a federal penitentiary just where he was serving when the whole election was overturned. Just days after the murders, Paul Gilley, Auburn Martin, and Claude Vealey were all arrested due to an overwhelming amount of evidence left at the crime scene, which, like, has to be even more overwhelming than the evidence that we have now that we can find in crime scenes, because this was the 1970s, 1969?
Yeah. Like,
So
they were touching everything, like handprints everywhere, like making sure that, like, they touched on the window, the doorknobs, like every possible thing that they could see. They were like, let me feel it. Because that's pretty much all people got caught with in the 1960s.
Fingerprints on everything. So Gilley was the son-in-law of a minor UMWA official, while Martin and Vealey were just two drifters in the right place at the right time. Because whenever they talk about their connections in the articles I read, it was always just like, these guys are criminals, so they decided to hire them.
Which, like, come on. Like you said, in the right place at the right time. Is that the right place? Probably not, if they got caught. They should have just kept on drifting.
Yeah. So, turns out executive council member of the UMWA, Albert Pass, had received $20,000 from Boyle to hire some gunmen to kill Jock back in September of 1969. This was a plan that had apparently been in the works since June, just a month after Jock announced his plans to run against Boyle. The two got into a heated argument that month, which ended in a screaming match in which Boyle had threatened Jock's life. And it didn't say whether he threatened him, like, during the argument or he told somebody. Because I did read that he had mentioned, I don't know if it was to Pass or if it was to someone else, of, like, we got to get rid of this guy. We got to take this guy out. Like, I'm just done. And I'm like, okay.
Well, and especially, okay, like, so then it's like, okay, this guy is such a ding dong, because, like, like, obviously everything was attributed to him, and then also somebody's obviously heard that you wanted to kill him, so it's like, dude,
yeah,
dude, no,
come on. From there, he had embezzled money from the union funds to give to Pass, so that way he could hire gunmen, which also was not a smart plan, because apparently Pass just went and found criminals off the street and was like, hey, go kill this guy. Yeah. So I don't know why he had such trust in him. And so,
didn't make the best choices. Although they got the job done.
They did. And thankfully they get caught for it. Yes. So I'm always thankful when criminals are really stupid.
Me too. Then,
yes, they committed this tragic murder, but at least they get caught for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Although he had been given the money in September, both men had agreed to postpone the murder till December to avoid making Boyle look suspicious. Which, like, you waited till the end of the month, just a few weeks after you win the election that everyone thinks you rigged anyway, to kill this guy to avoid suspicion. Like, for real?
No sense. No sense at all.
No. Also, back then, now that I'm thinking about this for the third time, like, wouldn't it have just been better? Because cars, I don't think, were the greatest back then.
Yeah.
Like, wouldn't it have been better to just catch him driving? Because these guys had been following him for a while, like, from what I read. And, like, wouldn't it have been better to just stage a car accident and been like, oh, no, my car slipped and blah, blah, blah. Because in Pennsylvania, it's snowy and icy, and I can imagine the roads weren't great. Like, that would have been a better... And, by the way, like, I know I'm saying this, but, like, I don't condone murder. Please don't use my ideas to kill anybody.
No, but I see what you're saying. It's like, try to cover it up is not a hit. Like,
yeah, because then there wouldn't be suspicious, right? Oh, these random dudes just, like, crashed a car into this guy. Like, yeah, that's unfortunate, but it would have been a while before they connected it to Boyle. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I don't know.
Yeah.
These guys are smart enough to become presidents of things, but they are not smart enough to, like, accurately plan out the, like, I don't know. It's just ridiculous. Anyways, again, I don't condone murder. Please don't murder people. Thank you. Once arrested, two of the convicted murderers accused Boyle, and he was indicted on 3 counts of murder in April of 1973 and convicted the following year. He was sentenced to 3 consecutive life terms in prison, where he would end up dying in 1985, and I believe it was something like a heart attack or heart failure or something like that.
So sadly quick and not painful.
Yes, and only like 10, 11 years into his sentence, so that's bullshit. Like, you barely spent any time.
Yeah, so
Your punishment was, I know he was in prison for a few years before because of the
embezzlement stuff,
but yeah, but still, not long enough for murdering an entire family for no other reason than you're a prick.
Yeah.
So, with Miller as the new president and Boyle in jail, Chip worked together with Miller as general counsel to rewrite the union's constitution and restore autonomy to the districts. And while he might not have been the best president, it did start, like, to improve the unions from then on. And so, despite the union not being what it is today, what Jock Yablonsky set out to do remains an important moment in history to this day. And yeah, so I just think it was really important to share because this guy kind of like, I mean, obviously we risked it all just to advocate for workers' rights and make sure these people were safe in this very, very dangerous job.
Yeah, which needed to be done because, yeah, the safety and the health of workers, like, probably was not top priority. Obviously not top priority for tough Tony.
Yeah, no, stupid Tony.
Yeah. We probably wouldn't have OSHA or anything if it wasn't for unions and people speaking up. So that's good. Although unions do leave open for just total corruption. So, I mean, you had Jimmy Hoffa with the Teamsters Union. I mean, he embezzled shit tons of money.
And so,
you know, I've...
Yeah, but anything with power like that, you're going to get corruption.
And then some unions, like a union I was a part of, did jack shit. And I felt like, what was the point of me paying my union dues if they weren't supporting or helping in any way?
Yeah.
For some unjust things. So, I mean, unions can be good, but you have to also watch and have some checks and balances. And hopefully corrupt people don't get into office to take advantage. But I think that's that way in anything. Like any job like can have corruption or shitty people. Yeah. So just have to be really careful.
Yeah. And just anything that has a position of power has the temptation or the opportunity for it. But you got to just look out, and some are better than others. I mean, it just depends. Oh, yeah. And so, like, unions were definitely a big part of my life. Like, my dad, most of my family, like, a lot of them are in the electrical union. So for me, like, it definitely helped my family and supported us and gave us things that we maybe didn't have previously. And so I definitely, I mean, my dad's doing big things. So definitely I support the IBEW and the electrical unions because it's like part of my family. My dad's doing good things.
And Chuck's a good guy. So when he does a lot for the unions, your dad. So I trust that union because I know Chuck's good.
Yeah.
So, changing the world, Chuck. We love ya. Yeah, I'm like he listens to our podcast. I'd be surprised.
He does
Although, can I tell you, that's unfair because, like, I don't know, the third, fourth time I met him, he made me listen to your brother's CD, like, while I was sitting and talking with him. So, he should be doing that for our podcast, too.
Yeah, he should be.
He's just a proud papa.
Yeah, he is.
I just thought it was the cutest thing ever. I was like, you are adorable, Chuck. I love you.
Yep. My dad's pretty great.
So
that was the story of Jock Yablonsky.
Well, thank you. It is important.
All right. So now it's time for our amazing holiday facts.
Woo woo.
Ooh, I like that little Vibrato. I feel like it gets better every time we do it.
Well, third time's a charm.
There you go. I know all the listeners are like, what the fuck are they keep talking about three times?
All right.
So, what fun fact do you have for us about Labor Day, since we are not in a specific state
this
week?
So, I'm going to share how we started celebrating Labor Day. So, during the height of the Industrial Revolution in the late 1800s, Americans were forced to work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. So, you mentioned Jock being 15 when he started working in the mines. Well, in some cases, kids as young as 5 years old were forced to work so that their families could have their basic needs met. In response to this, and to get a much-needed day off, workers ended up taking an unpaid day off on September 8th, 1882, and marched from City Hall to Union Square in New York City. Thus was the first Labor Day parade. Quickly after that, other cities started following suit, and 12 years later, it became a national holiday to celebrate the wonderful American worker. And that's awesome. Why we celebrate Labor Day.
That's great. Thank you guys for the day off and the great labor practices we have today.
That's right.
Also, I said great. They're not always great.
No.
But we're getting there.
We'll pretend as we celebrate Labor Day.
Yes. And so my fact, since Amber gave us the history of Labor Day, I wanted to give a fun fact about a saying that has to do with Labor Day. So we've all heard the famous like fashion faux pas of not wearing white after Labor Day. And so that actually came from something and like an actual like fashion rule in the early 1900s. In the early 1920s, like the 1900, 1910, 1920 period, the summer season really took place between Memorial Day and Labor Day, so basically the end of May, beginning of September. Society would flock from their towns and their cities to go to seaside cottages or mountain cabins to get away from the heat. So they would leave their city clothes at home in exchange for lighter, whiter summer outfits. So come Labor Day in September, they would return to the city, put away their summer clothes, and change back into their more formal city clothes. And since fashion was like a huge thing in this time period and they had dress codes for like everything, it was good to not wear white after Labor Day because you were back from the summer. So there was no point to be wearing white anymore. So then it just stuck that you weren't wearing your summer clothes. You were back to your city clothes again.
So yeah. We can wear white whenever the hell we want to now, except for I don't because I'm messy and accident prone and spill prone and everything. So my white clothes would not be white for long.
And so, so now obviously that doesn't track anymore because we don't get summer holidays to go spend at the cottage or the cabin, even though that would be nice.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, but now you can wear white whenever you want because we wear whatever color we want at any time in the year.
Yeah.
Plus, if you live anywhere in the Central Valley, if you live anywhere in the desert, like, you're wearing white pretty much the entire year because it is about to be September and it is still, like, triple digits.
Oh, it's hot as shit.
Like, for the next 10 days. So. Yeah. I mean, there we go.
Yeah, so that rule does not pertain to us. First of all, because we don't celebrate summer like that. And second of all, it's hot.
So thank you guys so much for listening to our special Labor Day episode. We really hope you enjoyed it because it took three takes to make. Make sure you like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at SOM Podcast. If you happen to like what you hear, which we hope you do, please consider leaving us a review on either Facebook or Apple Podcasts, because that helps people find us. If we have good reviews, they're more likely to listen and fall in love with us the same way that we hope you're in love with us. And so leave us a review. As always, if you have any corrections, if you have any cases for cities that we have come, or cities, states that we have coming up that you want us to cover, if you just want to say hi to us, feel free to email us at stateofmurderpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. We are also still doing our ongoing election stuff. So if you have registered to vote and plan on voting, if you have filled out your census, if you live in the United States,
please let us know and we will give you a shout out in the beginning of the next episode, just like we did in this one and the last one. So we'd like to hear from you guys. Do your civic duty. It's awesome. Get out there, vote. Fill out your census if you live in the U.S. Well, generally, I think if you do the census anywhere, you should fill it out. But right now in the United States,
yes,
at the time this podcast is released, you will only have 27 more days to fill out your census because they are shutting it off early this year. Also, if you don't want a census worker to come to your house and bug you about it, you should just do it yourself online. It takes less than 5 minutes and it helps the funding in your community for the next 10 years. So help somebody out and fill out the census.
Yes.
Yeah, so next week we will be in Alabama, like we mentioned last time. And yeah, that's it, guys. Have a happy Labor Day weekend, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.